Okay, so it is my great pleasure to introduce Chen Li, whom I've known, of course, for many years. He did his PhD at Stanford. He's now a full professor at UC Irvine, University of California, Irvine. His area, like mine, has been around data management system, mostly query processing, text analytics, and query processing means both execution and optimization. He got the NSF Career Award. He was also our program co-chair for VLDB 2015. Yes, mm-hmm. And he also did a startup. So it's a full package. So without much further introduction, Chen, take it away, and he's going to talk about two of his research projects.
All right. So thanks for hosting my visit. It's been a while for me. Last time I visited here was more than maybe 5 years ago. And it's good to see all the old friends, also to see some new faces. So the last few years at Surajit, I took some adventure to try to do a startup to commercialize some of my work. It's a pretty eye-opening experience, pretty interesting. I'm pretty sure for people who have done a startup before, like a Don, you know how it feels. And I came back about 2 or 3 years ago, that experience taught me many things. So one thing I learned was being in academia or in general in this research field, building systems is more exciting. Even before I did a startup, we together with my colleague Mike Carey, we were building an open source project called AsterDB, which I'll talk about briefly. And after I came back, I continued developing that project and also built some other systems. And so in this talk, I want to use the time to give you an overview of what I've been doing for the last few years. And I want to make a talk a little bit high level. Two places I will become technical, but you're very welcome to talk about some of the technical details. In addition, I talk about two systems, and both systems have demos. And I want to spend about two-thirds of my time on the first system and then one-third of time on the second system. But we can always talk offline about some of the issues. So the first project is called CloudBerry. And the motivation is about how to support big queries in sub-seconds. Okay. And I know I talked to some of the colleagues here. I know there are a lot of work in this space. And I'm telling you what do we want to do in this space. So at a high level, CloudBerry is a general purpose middleware solution which can support interactive analytics and visualization. And it supports different kinds of backends, different databases. Of course, we have the bias of supporting AsterDB, but it also supports other databases. And we also support different kinds of frontends. So even though the first demo, is about kind of a visualization, I want to emphasize this project is not about visualization. It's about supporting visualization. For example, Tableau can be one of our front-end users. Okay, so I'm going to start the first part with the demo. So the demo I'm going to show here is both demos about social media analysis, even though both solutions are general purpose. So for this demo, we call it Twitter Map. It's one application of CloudBerry. I want to differentiate between CloudBerry and Twitter Map because CloudBerry can support different kinds of applications. For this Twitter Map demo, the backend has about this number of tweets, close to 1 billion tweets collected over 1 year and 10 months, starting from November 2015. It's about roughly 1% of all the US tweets. Okay, still it's a small number. I know many people have seen bigger scales, but it's a proof of concept. And plus, the backend is using parallel solutions. So if you have more data, we could just throw in more hardware. So the whole thing is scalable. So the goal we want to achieve in this project is for this amount of data with textual, temporal, and spatial conditions, we want to allow the user to be able to see the data from different angles by submitting different kinds of conditions. Okay, so one example is currently we have this Hurricane Irma coming, and here we are lucky because we're in the northwest, they're better far from Florida. But let's say we want to see how the social media is talking about hurricane. Okay, so we can just type in the keyword hurricane, even though you can type in any keyword. So the user type in this keyword and want to see all the tweets, the aggregation results, a number of tweets mentioning hurricane per state. We show the map with the aggregation results. We also show the histogram over different time periods. So you can see some of the sample tweets here. Currently, it is like a 141. And this one, like 139, is real. I didn't censor the tweets. Right? So don't be offended by the words there. It's very organic. We get some rough idea about the distribution. And people may say, what if you look at the population of one state and do the division or do the normalization? We can allow you to do normalization to see, on the average, how many tweets per person are talking about the hurricane in each state. You can still get the idea. Still, you can see Texas and Florida, these are two states that are very, people are very concerned about this topic.
Virginia appears to be very concerned also, for whatever reason.
And so
it's
interesting. You see the two peaks. The second peak is not surprising. There's a peak here. Maybe for some reason, last summer there was some hurricane that was very troublesome. So you can just you can pick a range for the time dimension, and then the results will be updated with those answers within that time range. And you can easily change your time window by changing the start time or ending time, or you can slide the window. And so as the user changes the conditions on the time dimension, and the system can responsively give the results for this amount of data. Okay, and then let's say, what if the user wants to go deeper into the data? So let's say in Texas, we want to see within Texas how the trees are geographically located based on different counties. So we zoom in, we show all the different regions, different counties, and then the color to indicate the density per county. Okay, and you can go even further down to even the county level. I pick just one of them, and then Houston. And then at this level, now we show the city level aggregate results. So now for us, we show three different levels. But you can define your own hierarchy, and we allow you to zoom in, zoom out in this space dimension and text and the time, different dimensions. And the main thing is for this 1 billion, about 1 billion records, which is about 1 terabyte of data, how can you do this kind of queries within sub-seconds? So this is what we want to achieve. And on the back end, this is the kind of the mini cluster we're using. Now we moved it into my office. The back end is running a cluster of six Nuke boxes. Each one is about $800 with half terabytes of SSD, 16 gigabytes of memory, and I think maybe 2 cores or 4 cores, I forgot. And we use heavily relying on the disk or the flash drive to make it scalable. Since the whole infrastructure is a parallel, if you have more data, just throwing in more boxes, the total budget is about less than $5,000. Okay, so within $5,000, we want to deliver this kind of user experiences. So now let's see what's happening behind the scene. So this is what CloudBerry is capable of doing. Architecture-wise, CloudBerry is a middleware that sits on top of your existing database. And the one we saw just now, the backend is using AsterDB. Because we have a connector that talks to the database using our native language, two languages, we're bilingual, EQL and SQL++. And we also recently just built one more connector, or two more connectors, one talking to MySQL, one talking to Postgres. For us, the requirement is your database should provide, your backend, not database, your backend should provide a query language, either through JDBC or RESTful API, so that the middleware can talk to you by issuing some queries. In addition, we made some assumptions. One assumption is the data for now is append only. Once your data, because some of the logic relies on the assumption, once the data is already inserted into your record tables, they are not modified anymore. We know a lot of cases satisfy this condition. We have one more assumption we'll show you later. And the Cloudera middleware does a lot of techniques, optimizations to deliver that kind of user experiences, which I'll explain later.
Do you allow joint queries?
We allow joint queries. We support all kinds of queries. We support group by. Okay, I talk about the front-end library, the front-end API here. Okay, we use the RESTful API, but the RESTful API is kind of a SQL using a JSON format. Okay, I use this one here. So for Azure DB, I think I just talked about briefly, Mike and I have been building, and with some other colleagues from Riverside and other Couchbase, we've been building this one for the last 7 years. It's at a high level, it combines the techniques from semi-structured data management, parallel database systems, and Hadoop and its friends into one system. It's open source in Java. Essentially, it is a parallel database system with all the support, storage, indexing, query processing, query optimization, query language, the whole stack. Okay, this is a shared nothing architecture. We don't take the other approaches like Oracle is taking in some of their products. We just assume people can throw in some commodity hardware easily to make it scalable. These are some of the features Azure DB has. Semi-structured data model. We support B-tree, R-tree, inverted index, all of them. That covers a lot of data types. We use RSM for dynamic data, similar to other systems like Mongo and Lucene. And we have our own runtime engine called Hyrax. We have our own query language. Now, previously it's called EQL, coming from XQuery. Now, people don't like XQuery. People like SQL. So we change it to SQL++. The plus-plus part supports semi-structured part. Okay. And we have been working with Couchbase very closely. And the recent announcement from them says Couchbase decided to use the backend Azure DB to support their analytics. So that's a 1 minute overview of Azure DB. So let me focus on Cloudberry. So let me first talk about this API here, and how the middleware talks to the front end. I'll use a very simple example. In an earlier demo, we used Hurricane, but here I use Zika, which is very similar. So from the front end application perspective, it would talk to Cloudberry through a RESTful API, because we know web service architecture is more integratable. Right? You can plug into any place. And plus, by doing this RESTful API, it can kind of provide a uniform interface for the front end to talk to this layer, which can talk to different databases. Potentially, this layer could do even integration from different databases. But for now, each instance only talks to a single database. So this is the query. You turn it into SQL, it's more like I want to get the number of tweets per state that mention the keyword Zika. Okay? And this is the SQL in a JSON format. Okay? But there is a different language. And we have many different ways to define certain properties, like what data set you're talking to, and what kind of predicates you want to ask or post to that table. When you do group by, on which attribute or attributes you want to do the group by, and when you do group by, what kind of aggregation you want to do? Count, sum, min, max, they're all configurable.
What about user-defined aggregates?
User-defined aggregates, so far, no. So we just do use a standard aggregates. So I want to mention a few things the middleware is doing to achieve that performance. I mentioned some of them in the meetings this morning. But one thing is caching. Okay, not surprisingly, in that example, if a user types in Hurricane, is the first time user types in Hurricane, then the engine will do the work. The middleware would translate that query into a SQL query to the backend, or even multiple queries, depending on the semantics, and then the results of the Hurricane query will be stored as a view and materialize inside the database as one of the tables. And from Databricks' perspective, they don't know what it is. It's just one of the tables. So it's up to the middleware to decide the meaning of this view and how to maintain it. Okay, this is the logic we do here. Later we'll cover the case where what if we don't have a view available there. Okay, that's a second technique that we're doing there. Now, at a high level, this one looks a little bit very overwhelming. The main idea is if the user has typed in a drug, a Zika, a hurricane, and then the system, the middleware has decided to put the results into a view, into a database, there's still a lot of issues we have to solve, which is how can we make the view consistent with the backend database? Because our principle is we want to support real-time query processing, meaning when a user types in a query, we want to give the user the latest results that just came in maybe 5 minutes ago. So to do it, our current solution is the developer, the system admin, has to decide the frequency in which the middleware and, or the view and the base table should be synchronized. So let's assume it's 1 hour. So every hour, the middleware will trigger logic to tell the database to put the latest tweets about hurricane, the delta, and put the delta into the view. Okay, this is done by the middleware. Okay, but there's still one issue, which is even if the view is maintained synchronized with the base table every hour, what if so? And now it's like a 150, right? 150. Last time it was synchronized at 1 o'clock. There are still some records that came in the last 15 minutes. So we also want to include this the latest tweets that came in the last 15 minutes in the results. So what the middleware is doing is, if at this moment that we ask for hurricane tweets, it will first talk to the view, which is for hurricane tweets, to fetch all the tweets, which is much smaller compared to the entire 1 billion record table. In addition, it will also talk to the base table to get all the tweets that just came in last 15 minutes. So then the middleware will do the combination.
Yeah, so I have two questions.
Sure.
So the first one is that do you just use the AstroDB as the storage engine for persistence of the data? It seems all the other parts are done in the middleware.
This is the backend, this is the middleware. So the view maintenance logic is done by the middleware. From an AstroDB's perspective, it's just a table.
So basically, the AstroDB is just storing the data and
yes,
the table.
Yes, just stores tables.
More like a storage engine.
Correct. Right.
The other thing is that you mentioned about the merging the results from archived data and new incoming data.
Right.
Do you assume the data is sort of append only in
yes.
some sense? Okay.
Yeah, that's why we made the assumption. We assume the data that came in last 15 minutes is not modifying early data. That's why we need this assumption. Do you have a question, Sergey?
No, I was just thinking that, you know, for example, in many cases, the data is going to come from a streaming system.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to, like, the ingestion time for this to get to
AstroDB, yeah.
Right there and so on would be kind of too long.
Yeah.
So if you have a pull from, let's say, I don't know, something that's coming from an event hub in Microsoft Staff or, for example, Kafka or in any of these sort of eventing system, then how quickly, that's one. And the main question there is related to that if your query is a dynamic query, means it's not a registered standing query, then many of the things that you're talking about, the views, are not really actionable. So how much flexibility are on the fly? So you have a rich API, but that's different from saying, can I write an ad hoc query just in time, and you can actually search the stream? So how do you sort of balance that?
Yeah, for the first one, about the data ingestion, we, in this architecture, we treat it as a problem for a database system.
I see.
If the data comes from the back door, as long as the data is, I mean, in terms of architecture, Cloudberry doesn't care about how data comes in. As long as the data is visible through a query, it will get it. Right, so it's really the database business to make sure if you have fast data that comes in the system, they are visible through the query. The transaction properties should be guaranteed. But Cloudberry doesn't care about the business.
I mean, I just think for many of the newly coming events or fire hose kind of situation, well, how realistic that assumption is, I don't know. I mean,
yeah, because when we develop this software, we assume we treat you as, I mean, we talked about this issue even earlier, we treat your database as a black box. And even later, the next thing we'll talk about is really about...
But with a rich query API.
Yes, it may basically SQL. For now, select, project, join, group by all the basic operations. Okay. This is what we need. And for the second issue, if you want to do a... I don't know what you really mean, like kind of a continuous queries. If the user subscribes to a query to a system, whether the system can... periodically or continuously give the user the update of that query. Is that what you mean?
That's not your model.
That's not my model. We're just a batch model.
Your model is an ad hoc, right?
Yeah.
Right at that point, I mean, actually, you're going to answer that question. You have never seen this query before, right?
Right.
So there's a distinction between a query template versus parameter of the query. I'm talking about the query itself, not the parameter of the query.
Mm-hmm. And so far, in the current way of doing the view materialization, we assume each view has a keyword for now.
Okay.
So we have a hurricane view, we could have a Irma view, we could have a Zika view.
Okay. And then they have to be known a priori.
No.
On the fly.
It's not on the fly.
Okay.
That's also different. I think in some of the earlier work, people have to do some kind of offline, collecting a histogram, other information. The one principle we follow is we start from scratch. The views will be on the fly created and maintained. We don't do offline data cubes. We don't do offline workload analysis and see which of the views should be virtualized. And one more thing that's very real to our case is, say, at least for this domain, text is very common. The user can type in arbitrary keywords. It's very hard to decide what kind of keyword they can provide. So we won't do everything on the fly. Okay, there's no offline process per step.
Do you always maintain the view inside the same database that the original data is in, or do you also provide for being able to do that in a separate system?
Yeah, so the question is really about do we always put the views into the same database? But currently we do. We assume we treat your backend database as a storage layer. And when I put some results there, you do it. But if possible, we can always have a separate database just to store views. Right? That's doable. We didn't do it. And other questions?
So I'm just curious whether the keywords, the search is exact keyword search or more than that?
So far, we haven't done any expansion, fuzzy matching, stemming, those things we have not done yet. This is only kind of the first step. I have one student who is working on this full text search feature there. We know how to do it, just a matter of time. Next thing I want to say is back to your tutorial, right? What if the views are not available? Right? The first time user it gives a query, hurricane, there's nothing inside the database as a views. How can we do it? People here are expert in the topic. So when we first developed a prototype 1 year ago, that's the first one is the user experience, which is really troublesome. Because whenever I show a demo, I always try to show a keyword I have issued before, but in the audience, people can give me some arbitrary keyword. This is what the user experienced, which is not nice. So what we decided to do, there are many different approaches. What we decided to do is this approach, which is you do query slicing. Okay, and I want to go a little bit deeper to this topic because I talked to some people in this audience. The reason we take this approach is we want to treat the backend database as a black box. We do not want to make any change to the database. We just assume you have a standard API, maybe a SQL API, and I want to develop a solution that does not have any a priori knowledge about your histogram. I can do this kind of user experience. And let me show you the example here. So what do we do? If I show you the solution, what do we do is very simple. One more assumption we make. We assume in your data or table, to be more specific, you can pick one attribute using which you can slice your query. This is the assumption we make. So in this example, we assume we pick the time of the tweet as a dimension. So as I mentioned in the meetings this morning, I have data for about 2 years. If I do a query for all the tweets, it takes long time to finish. But instead, I can give you the results. First, give you the results for 1 week, and then maybe a second week, a third week. And hopefully, by dividing this big query to these small queries, we call them mini queries, each of the mini queries is more responsive. At the same time, we want to progressively give you the update. Okay? So one very simple solution is the following. As I said, I do it week by week. Okay? So this is the behavior. So in this demo, in this implementation, in our first implementation, we just fix the interval size, like 1 week or 1 month. So I do one query to give me all the results for January, and then results for February, results for March, and I piece them together. Okay? We see a lot of issues here. First issue is skewness. Data is not uniform distributed. So of course, we assume there is a kind of index structure on this attribute. By accessing that index structure, you can the mini query is much faster. But still, even in this case, since the distribution of that dimension is not uniform, you get this behavior. Sometimes it can be really fast. Sometimes it can be very slow. Especially in the hurricane example, you can see last summer there's a peak. Right? Once you go to that range, then the engine is very busy processing that query. The user will wait for a long time. This is one drawback. The other drawback is even for the database itself, even if the distribution is uniform, okay, still, your database is busy with many other queries. Right? Even in a multi-tenant environment, your virtual machine might be serving lots of different tenants. So even the behavior of the database can be very unpredictable.
I'm missing the basic idea of slicing. So from a user's point of view, let's say I have an average query, average aggregate. Mm-hmm. So when you underneath, you're doing some slicing that I don't know about.
Yes.
Right? So you're giving me an answer for, let's say, some slice, and that has a certain average. Now, once you add the second slice, that average may go up or down, change drastically. So as a user, what do I see?
You see this. So what the system doing is give the results progressively.
No, but I'm saying that okay, if you look at something like online aggregation, mm-hmm. there was some at least confidence interval of the answer. Here, yes. You don't have that.
Okay. This one, to some degree, you can say this is also one way to do sampling. Right? I'm doing sampling in a very consistent way, and I don't have any assumption about the distribution. That's why I cannot give you any confidence. If you do some like a random sampling or some of the work the team here is doing, or you look at what Joe Hellestein has done like 20 years ago on online aggregation, some of the approaches have this assumption that the database engine supports random sampling. And we don't have the luxury here. We want to take the approach where I just have a database sitting there, I don't know what's inside it, and I don't want to modify a database, and can I do something in the middleware that can be very self-adaptive? So in this whole solution, when we started the system, the collaborator system, it doesn't know anything about database, except, of course, API. And so the distribution of that dimension, I don't know, especially since the user can type in any keyword. I cannot build a histogram for every keyword, or even combinations of keywords. And even the behavior of the database engine can be very unpredictable. Suddenly it becomes faster, sometimes it can be even slower, and the middleware should be able to adjust itself to give you the very smooth experience. So this is the approach we take. Right? Of course, which one is right depends on the scenario. If you have the access to source code, you have the luxury to modify your source code to provide this say random sampling interface, you should go with that approach. But the approach we take assumes you just have a black box.
The only assumption you need is the data are partitioned by time, and so you can query a specific time range.
Right. We assume you have one attribute using which you can do query slicing.
But that attribute has to match the grouping attribute or
not? Not necessarily.
So any attribute whatsoever?
But you can go deeper to see the I think you can come up with some requirements on the slashing attribute. But in this query, it's a group by state. A group by state. And what we're doing is we just first get all the, at a high level, get all the results for, say, for January, and then do the count. And those one requirement is kind of the results are aggregatable, right? Assumable. Or you can keep some small results, you put them together. But at a high level, the requirement for the slicing attribute should be very, very, very minimal.
So, like you said, this you're taking data week by week, right?
Right.
So, I'm just asking whether it's configurable that you were taking it week by week or state by state, because you could also do it state by state, right?
Yeah. So we make the software. We try to make the middleware configurable by allowing the user to say, I do it week by week or month by month. But I want to mention that you could take the approach, but that experience is not very pleasant. Exactly, I showed here, if you just do it on a fixed interval, due to the behavior of the distribution and the database engine, the times of delivering results are not very smooth. We want to give the user a very smooth, or what we call the rhythmic approach. That's exactly the solution we came up with. We just finished a paper just maybe 2 weeks ago. So the idea is the following. At a high level, how can the middleware decide a slicing interval for the backend to make sure the execution time of the mini query can be finished in the kind of fixed time? Okay. Suppose, that, let's say, 2 seconds. Suppose when you develop a system, you want to say the middleware should give the frontend update every 2 seconds. Suppose this is a configuration. And more like a dancing rhythm here. How can you make sure every 2 seconds you give the front-end update instead of using a delivering results at different times? So the key challenge is how can the middleware model the behavior of the distribution and also model the behavior of the engine at the black box and then be adapted by itself?
Maybe I'm missing something. So there is one, of course, a time constraint of 2 seconds, right? So set that aside. Thus, if I view that as a constraint, I get that. Is that an optimizing function?
There's no. We in this formulation, we don't assume you had to finish by a certain deadline. We don't have the assumption.
You have the assumption.
We don't have the assumption.
You don't have.
We just want to give the results, whatever time it takes. We have to give the results. We don't have this deadline notion here. So the focus of this work is more about the rhythm. How can I give you the results using this fixed 2 second windows?
But what is the trade off? I mean, can you make that window like every hour, right? You know, slice can be very small.
Yeah. But we assume this 2 second, this parameter is given by system admin. So, I mean, as a system admin, you want to develop a system, you say, I want to give the user an update every 2 seconds. 2 seconds parameter you can tune. It can be 2 seconds, could be 1 second, could be 5 seconds.
And that's the update time, not the slice time, right?
Exactly. So that the middleware has to figure out the slicing time. This is exactly the issue we had to solve. So the system tells the system, give the user update every 2 seconds.
So the question I was getting is, okay, you have to pick the slice. Okay, I got it. You'll talk about that. But if this itself is over-constrained, mm-hmm. or it is a situation that multiple solutions are involved, I can sort of slice in some 15 ways, then is there a desirable properties of this or an optimizing function for this that you're trying to get to, right?
Okay.
But otherwise, I as a user, I'm looking at, let's say you fix... do it non-deterministically.
One time,
I get a certain behavior, another time, and given that there is no statistical basis for it, I don't know how to interpret it.
That's the purpose of this link.
Okay.
So using a very simple example, let's say we consider three different ways to deliver results. Okay. The first way, I just ask for the whole range, and this is called a schedule, and this schedule takes 6 seconds to finish. But during 6 seconds, the user has to wait. Okay. A second schedule, magically, you can give the user update every 2 seconds, and all these four queries run in the same time. Of course, altogether, it takes longer time, 8 seconds, but the update is very regular, very rhythmic. Okay. The third approach also issues four queries. And the first query took 1 second, the second query took 3 seconds, the third took one second, the fourth took 3 seconds. So these four different queries, they finished at different times. Okay. Now, if you just, whenever you get the result, you give the result back to the user. Now this one, the user sees the result after 1 second, and then the user will wait for some time. After 2 seconds, there's no update. The user has to wait for like one more second to get the results. Okay. And the third one, the user gets the results immediately after 1 second. The fourth one, the user still needs to wait for like 1 second after the 2 second deadline. Okay. So back to your question, Sarjit. So I have three different ways to deliver results. How can we quantify the quality here? Right. So we need to come up with a notion to say which is better. Okay. Now, when you come up with a metric, there's no single answer here, right? So, but I give you our answer to the question. We consider two things in this formulation. One, total running time. Ideally, you want to make it as small as possible, right? Because overall, you don't want the user to wait for a long time. The second thing we also care about is if there's a pace, let's say 2 seconds. That means every time the user gets updated, the next time the user gets updated, you want the user, you do not want the user to wait for more than 2 seconds. Okay? If the next query comes in after 2 second deadline, the longer the user waits, the more penalty you had to pay. So what we formulate the problem, the second issue is what we call the smoothness of the result delivery, which is suppose this is your previous mini query that ends here. To maintain this pace, you can still wait for some time for the middleware to give the results. And suppose this is a 2 second window, but the next query can be issued right after the first one was finished. Okay, but if this one took longer than expected, if it finishes here, then during this period, the user has to wait. So the second factor we have to consider in this whole quality metric is how much delay the user has to wait. Okay. Ideally, we want to minimize the total running time. We also want to minimize the total number of waiting time for the user. So the solution we come up with, the answer we have is a combination of the two factors. The total running time, which is we call the cost T, and the total delay, and we use the constant to decide how much penalty we want to give to the total delay. Okay. Of course, we can talk about whether this one is really the golden standard, but the idea is there, a combination of both factors.
So if you are conservative, and if you use a very small slice, say 1 millisecond,
yes,
then DI will be basically zero.
Yes, but this one will be very long.
I see, so the cost will be higher.
Because you're sending a lot of queries to the backend.
And how do we model that cost?
For now, for our approach, we just measure time. Again, we don't know how many CPU cycles, resources available in the database system. We don't have the access. So the easiest way is just to measure time. Of course, if you have the access to the database resources, you can come up with a better way to model the cost.
So just a clarification again. So are these mini queries, are they being executed in parallel, some of them, or it's a very sequential?
So far, in a current implementation, we assume they are done sequentially. We did one experiment where the middleware could send a model queries at the same time. Our finding is you are kind of overdoing your work, right? You're competing resources with other people. So you could do it, but for our solution, we assume we do it sequentially. Okay.
So the metric that you're saying is running time, or is it like...
This one?
Yeah.
This is total running time.
But when you're trying to optimize, figure this out in the quote-unquote in your planning phase,
right,
you don't have access to that.
We don't have it. So this is more like a ruler to measure the quality. And in the beginning, we tried to formulate a kind of an optimization problem. We found it really hard because it's an online problem. Everything can change as you run the student schedule. So what we do is we take a greedy approach, meaning every time when I generate the next mini query, based on this function, I try to be very greedy. I don't claim any optimality. At the end, when I generate a schedule, I use this function to measure the quality of my schedule. So I don't go with this optimality guarantee. I'm just greedy. Okay, so this is a framework of what we are doing. We call it DRUM, which stands for DRUM results upon milestones. Okay, so more like the rhythm. When you use a drum, you see the pace, you have to meet the requirement. So the idea, I mean, you have seen this structure in many other places. The whole framework is very adaptive, meaning you have a query, and the middleware will generate, initially generate some very conservative mini queries by using very small intervals. Okay, you first give some results. And then you send the mini query to the backend, and then the backend gives the results. The middleware also keeps track of the numbers, performance. And that information will be fed into this module to model the behavior of the engine. That information will be used by the generator to decide next mini query. So that's why it's very self-adaptive.
So this adapts the width of the slices that you're doing to generate the mini queries.
Correct.
Do you also do any adaptation about choosing a different dimension along which to do the slices?
We don't do it. The reason is, from the user experience perspective, the UI is fixed.
Right? So in your example, it's always time.
In that example, it's always time. We fix it. Because if you try the middle, you change to the space, the UI doesn't look good. So this is my idea. Okay. So now talk about the details. We want to model the relationship between the slicing time and runtime. So the one thing we have is a regression model. So we're doing linear regression, but you can pick any other regression model. Any regression model cannot be perfect. We also have a model to model the behavior or the errors. Okay, and I think maybe I already spent almost like 40 minutes, and I think you get the main idea what we're doing here. So if you don't mind, I can just wrap up this one and move on to the next one here. But you get the main idea. We try to use this middleware to do responsible queries without making a very strong assumption about the backend database. This is what we do. Okay.
Just one question.
Sure.
Do you have any user studies to show that users prefer this constant query response time?
We don't. We were talking to our HCI faculty to see if we can do user study. I think this is their expertise, Alfred Kopsa. We haven't done it yet. But from our bias in perception, we see the fixed interval doesn't look good.
So this is slicing considering the time, right? So what I was thinking is that always the time might not be the thing. It might be that you slice only for 1 second. However, the amount of data that comes for that one second be a lot. So shouldn't you consider the slicing as some estimation of how many data will come on that slice and the timing together?
Exactly. When we decide the slicing interval width, we do consider the factor.
How do you estimate that the amount of data compensated?
That's the answer is a combination of the regression and the error model. We try to, intuitively, if I want to finish a query within 2 seconds, by using the linear model, maybe I should have used maybe 7 days. But I use a 7-day window, I have a risk of missing deadline. So I should be a little bit conservative, maybe by using maybe 5 days or 4 days. So that is already captured by the error model there. So I'm not targeting just to finish the whole thing within 2 seconds. That's too risky. I need to be a little bit conservative. But that's the intuition of our approach.
So given all that discussion, like, it seems that the user study of this experience seems kind of crucial, which is something at least database people generally suck at.
Yeah. You answered my question, right?
So how you kind of, it's kind of so much tied to the HCI and all.
Yes, yes.
And I'm not sort of
Sergey, you have been recorded.
So I'll just answer my question.
I think this is not the first time people are suggesting us to do user studies. I think we should do it. We should do it.
Okay.
I'm recorded. So I want to use the remaining time to talk about the second system.
About this decision of slicing, how much to slice and all. in this case, as far as I could understand, wouldn't a simple histogram help you here?
I don't have the histogram.
And is it particular to a database? Because in relation
it's hard. I had a discussion this morning. If the user can type in some arbitrary keywords, how can I build a histogram for some keyword I don't know a priori? I don't. I start from scratch. The settings are different. All right, so I want to take the remaining time to talk about second system, which is, to me, also very exciting. I did a lot of work in text processing. I did a startup about text processing. And I feel text is a very rich domain. There are a lot of opportunities. The new system I'm building is called the Textera. In the earlier abstract, I used TextDB. Later, we renamed it because it's not a database system. At a high level, it is a system that that supports cloud-based text processing. Okay, and I'm going to show you, the reason is everybody in this room can write code. Some people without IT background, they cannot write code. But how can we make it easier for these people, including us, to do some text processing very easily without writing a single line of code? Right? If I can finish one thing within 5 minutes, I do want to do it in 1 hour. It's about the cost. Okay, so what we're building is a web service called Textera, using which a system can easily drag and drop some basic operators to formulate a workflow. Okay? I didn't install any software. Everything's based on web. So here, I'm also using Twitter as one example. And so I can just say, look at scan. I refresh the page. So I want to allow a person to analyze tweets without writing a single line of code. So I can say, I do a scan. Okay, and I have a lot of tables there. I pick one table called with the data for last 1 week. And then I can just see the results. And we know this is a select star query with a limit. So two operators. And I run a query. And I should be able to see some of the sample tweets. Okay, maybe within 10 seconds, I can do it. So, but that's not the end of it. So let's do more analysis. Suppose I only want to look at all the tweets mentioning a particular keyword, say hurricane. So I go here, I do a search, I do a keyword search, and I need to specify the attribute. And the keyword I use like a hurricane, and I give a name of the results, like a as operator, search results. So I link these two operators and these two operators. So this is a new query. Okay, so you can click each of them, you see, this one should have a hurricane here, okay? So other analysis. Suppose I want to do entity recognition, okay? So what I can do is I go to this menu option, I pick entity recognition, and I pick one of the attributes, and I want to locate, pick one of the types, noun, verb. Suppose I want to look at locations, okay? And I say location results. Okay.
So are you looking for all the results, or like I want to see, is there a notion of ranking? Is there a notion of top 10? Or because
we have a limit. You know, databases people are not good at the ranking. We give you 10, you pick out. That's the difference between IR and database, you know it.
So with entity recognition, in my experience, that is an operator that is incredibly sensitive to context and whether I want to recognize products, historical figures, other stuff. Now, how can you have a sort of a general purpose single entity recognition operator?
This standard entity recognizer is wrapping Stanford NRP.
Okay, so you basically sort of offload
we wrap them
to someone else. Okay.
We wrap Lushin, we wrap Stanford NRP, we wrap NRTK, we wrap these guys.
But so, when you do it, still, what you're positioning this as is a one-stop shop for all sorts of domains and
yes,
tasks, right?
Yes.
So in a way, whatever you wrap still has to generalize. And
correct.
Is in your experience, is that the case? Or is there some way to customize the
entity recognition?
It's
both. Recognition? If you look at me, we talk about Lushin, right? We talk about Lushin. Lushin very powerful search engine, stemming, ranking, a free search, multi-language support, they're all available. We just wrap it and bring it back to you. And some of the operators are using Lushin. Stanford NLP, standardized with Rapid. But at the same time, if the user wants to add their own logic, we should allow the user to do it.
So there's one interpretation of this, which is a query builder. And all I'm doing is that I have individual components and I'm just piping, but not necessarily pipelining, but a workflow kind of stuff.
Correct.
Right? And it's just that. It's a visual thing and the boxes are what they are.
Right.
What is the semantics of this workflow? Well, I mean, for each one, figure it out what it is, and whatever the semantics is, I take the results and put it in this pipe, and that's it, right?
Right.
Is this how I should view it, or this is something else?
It's for text.
What?
It's a meaning for text.
That's okay, but is that
the... do we have a solution on the market? I don't see it.
No, I didn't say. I was trying to understand what you're doing. I'm not challenging you.
You're welcome to challenge me. That's fine. But I don't see any solution on the market. There are solutions that are standalone software packages like NIME, RapidMiner, Alteryx. These are the few solutions, either open source or proprietary. They're not open. They're not web-based. They're not cloud-based. And from a user perspective, they do not want to install softwares.
Do you have any debugging support for this?
We will.
Or sort of to ask the question in a different way. Let's say I firmly believe in Vivek's entity extractor as being far superior.
I can wrap him.
I'm going to wrap him.
He's very good at this. Yeah. What would it take for me to actually integrate one specific entity recognizer in your software?
Yeah.
Is that possible?
Yeah, it is possible. First of all, it took us about 1.5 years to reach this milestone. Saying and doing the different, it took a lot of time to reach this step. The few things that we are doing, I want to summarize the few things we're going to do. One, extensibility. If you have your own logic or even some package you want to wrap, we want to make the process very easy. We want to support Python, we support Java and R. These are common languages. How can we allow the developer to wrap their own logic into this whole pipeline? That's one, we had to do it. Second is debuggability. Right? And when you have this long-running job on a very large number of records, the whole execution can take a long time. How can you give the user some kind of a progress report of where you are in the whole execution and allow the user to even pause one of the operators and do some investigation of the state of that operator, those intermediate results, even do some data lineage to see where that record comes from? We had to allow the user to debug it. Okay.
It's more than just debugging, right? If I know, like, principally, let's say, sort of all names that have a middle name that's a single initial are misrecognized.
Right, right.
How do I actually then enable that feedback, right? It's one thing to recognize that. It's another thing to actually systematically modify my entity recognition component.
Yeah, so far we don't have the feedback mechanism.
Right.
We don't have it yet. I mean, we talk about the trifecta, right? These kind of softwares, they are very powerful in terms of allowing the user to highlight some of the places, and then they can recommend some rules here. And we are not there yet. I mean, down the road, let me talk about the current focus. Extensibility, debuggability, and usability. And one more thing we care about is really about the potential scalability. And so far, the whole thing runs on a single engine, and nothing can prevent us from running one operator in a parallel environment, because we know text processing can be very, very expensive, can take hours or days to finish. So if we can parallelize the execution of each operators to this cluster, then that's even more powerful. So these few utilities have not been done yet. This is only the initial prototype. And the good news is, for both systems I'm presenting here, they are used by people. As I said in my talk abstract, we are working with some UCI researchers. They're not from ICS. They are working on public health, politics, to use social media to do their analysis. And they love the first demo because they can easily see the data. And they also use this one here because they do not want to write a program. They do not want to install softwares. They do not want to apply patches. And this is the big advantage of the cloud-based trend. I mean, everybody here knows how important trend is, the cloud is. And we believe, even if you take the idea of like either RapidMiner or NIM, but push it to the cloud and make it very easy to use and make the execution detached from the front end, and the user can access the execution from anywhere, even allow multiple users to share that execution interface, this is very powerful. That's why now Google Docs is very, very, very easy to use because multiple people can share the same document. This infrastructure can allow multiple developers to share the same workflow without using a remote desktop. Right? So I believe this is the trend. And a lot of the new challenges we have to solve in this new architecture here. And we're still in building this. Okay. You get the main idea. So it's a wrapped or few, Luxin, NRTK, stands for NRP, maybe a Vivix future module, we're going to wrap it. And then we want to make it extensible by allowing the user to write out their own logic. So those things are really, really happening here. So, wait, what's the technical part? Technical part, you already got a second technical part. Let me give you maybe one slide here. One interesting thing is how to, so if you, some people ask the question, how is it different from database engine? Okay? At the high level, it's all about operators forming a DAG. Well, at that level, they are the same. But the main difference is inside database system, people don't interact with operators. People interact with the system using SQL, using string. But here, the user can interact with each operator. Okay, so the architecture is very different. A second difference is inside database system, how many operators we have? Maybe 30, 40 at the most, right? But in this text domain, there's so many different operations you can do. The number of operators is much, much larger. I heard RapidMiner, they claim they have more than 1,000 operators for different purposes because they have this architecture, whole architecture that allows a new user, developer, to contribute new operators to the whole framework. Because the whole thing is very open, very extensible. Now, when you develop such an engine, how can we make it easy for a new operator to implement it? That's very different from a database case where everything is under control, but here is more open-ended. So what we do in our current engine is every operator has a kind of a descriptor in a JSON format. The descriptor has all information about this operator in addition to the code. Of course, you have to have the code logic. The descriptor could have like how many input, what's the input arity, what's the output arity, and whether even you look at the front end, what kind of icon you want to use, and what kind of description you want to attach to this operator. And from a developer's perspective, as long as you use a framework to describe a new operator with the code and the metadata, the whole thing will be integrated to the whole system very easily.
So like if I take an arbitrary operator, somebody else's code, there may not be the serialization logic there. So who has to write that?
I mean, so first of all, we have not done the UDF part yet, right? Because I'm not saying every package can be wrappable.
Okay.
Right, the Vivix module might not be wrappable, but there's certain protocol the person has to follow. Well, what's the input? What's the output? Right. So, but I want to identify the commonality and make it easier for the developer to write a piece of code. So far, the way we integrated NRTK, which is in Python, is pretty interesting because we try different ways to include Python in our Java engine. And the one approach is to use a Java class to interpret all the different Python code. The other one is running the Python as a separate process. And let JVM and the Python process use IPC to communicate. And we take the second approach. But even for the second approach, there's one question, which is how the JVM and the Python process share information back and forth, and how you can minimize the overhead by doing batching. Right? Those things need to be figured out.
It seems to me that, I mean, are you familiar with something like SQL Server Integration Services,
mm-hmm.
which has a very similar sort of flavor in the sense that there are a bunch of built-in operators which you as a user can connect for your task. And and they also have custom script operators that you can write your own script and put it into the thing. And as long as it meets certain input-output criteria, you can plug it in anywhere into the pipeline.
Yeah.
So in a sense, those kinds of engines have been built, right? So what do you see as the new challenges because it's text processing?
I'm not saying this idea of formulating a workflow using drag-droppable operators is new. Microsoft did it, and RapidMiner did it, and I believe that the uniqueness here is the cloud. I believe if you pick some idea, you can make a similar argument, why does Microsoft move from Office to Office 306? You have to move everything to a cloud. And that is architecture shift. Now, previously, you run the whole thing on your single desktop. I don't know the software you mentioned. I saw some GUI to formulate the query. I saw that interface. I don't know what's the one you talk about. But in general, I believe the software you talk about is something running on a local machine.
The SSIS is for the ETL-like scenario, primarily targeting to
that. Right. So, but I don't know whether it's a cloud-based software. I don't know yet.
So we can take it offline, but yeah.
I guess the question is basically, because it's cloud-based, what changed?
So
as a functionality, to your point, with the examples you gave of Office 365 and whatnot, makes sense, right? I mean, there's nobody's questioning that. But from a technical perspective, what changed because of that?
I don't have a perfect answer to your question because we are also exploring. I really do the project based on my gut feeling here because I see people want this. This is my short answer, not technical answer. But if you go deeper, I believe first, when you go to cloud, there's a very big potential of automatically scale up the whole computation. Right? If you have a job that's very expensive to run, then in the cloud, you have a much better freedom to scale, to launch multiple virtual machines, to parallelize some of the operators. The web gives the opportunity.
Right.
I don't think single machine does not give the opportunity.
Assuming you have the parallelization logic.
Yes, right. That one is a new opportunity you cannot explore on a single desktop. Right. In addition, in terms of the user experience, I think it's very different. Of course, you might not say it's technical, but when designing architecture, since we're using this client-server architecture, the execution of your logic should be detached from your front end. Right? You can easily set up and open a new browser and attach to that one here. Right? So you can say it's engineering, technical, we don't know, but you had to think about this whole thing very differently. You can say the idea has been implemented by RapidMiner. And RapidMiner is using everything as a Java program running on a single machine, but I believe softwares like RapidMiner have spend a significant amount of effort on UI design there. That's why it's very hard for them to migrate to the web cloud. They can't. They have a burden they had to carry with them. Right? Because for us, we start from scratch. From day one, we do the web interface. So maybe 1 year, 2 years down the road, I have more technical answer to your question. Yeah.
You're going to have to beat Unix pipes. I mean, basic. It's very interesting to listen to the questions. Everybody here is a database person, right?
yeah. You are also a database person.
The thing that would this kind of thing, and that Unix pipes were actually used exactly for this. It was, except it's not JSON.
Yeah.
It's a different data model. It's, you know, comma or space separated fields, carriage return separated.
I would say awk is probably
exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, you talk about the cloud in terms of scale out, but I probably the first thing that people would worry about is how to get parallelism on a multi-core machine that with shared memory, because there are a lot of performance issues there. We know just for database processing, query processing, to get the most out of the machine. And I have a hard time thinking about text processing that is of such a scale that you would go to multiple machines to get there.
I have 1 billion tweets to deal with. And a user does not want to wait for a long time. So having the ability to run the whole thing on 100 machines will help for sure. But back to your question, I agree with you that even on a single machine, there is a lot of potential to parallelize the computation using multiple cores. But strategically, back to a surges question, I will not focus on that one yet. Because that issue also exists on a single desktop software.
So if I understand you right, you are not suggesting, what you are really talking about is I'm trying to see in terms of the machine architecture in the cloud, how does it look? Like, you have these individual boxes. Mm. I can sort of think of them as a bit of like microservices. I can say, hey, they have their own cluster, they have their own parallelization logic, they run on their own, you know, in their own VMs.
Right.
And your stuff runs as an orchestration service where they send it back and you connect to all these microservices. If you really want to be kind of cloud native, you should think in terms of microservices in that case, right? But then there are all kinds of issues, right? I mean, in that case, your storage compute, you just have a REST API through which you're communicating, and that's pretty much it. So it's in some ways it's a narrow pipe, if you will, right?
Yeah.
And you can't assume anything where they are on what side of the network, they may not be on the same rack, or you can't make any assumption on where those machines are. So to get there, the question is to get the right performance architecturally. What are you assuming? So as you said, the model is not new. You're going to cloud. But with that comes a question, what is running where? What data is shared? Where is the network? How much is being transmitted across the network? And what are the assumptions?
Very good point. There are a lot of questions about architecture. We could run each of the operators as a microservice, using some standard RESTful API. We're looking at the architecture where we use the, I think they're called actor model. We're using that model.
You should just talk to Phil.
Funny thing about that, I'm next on the agenda.
Well, that's a coincidence.
Phil gets another half an hour extra.
so we hopefully by the end of this quarter, by the end of this year, we're going to switch the whole thing to the actor model. Because the idea is... So the idea is each operator is running as a thread with a separate queue, and all the different operators communicate with each other by sending messages to the queue. And then a big advantage of this architecture is I can pause it. Because each of the actors is running using a thread, I can pause the thread. Currently, I'm using a single thread, using the pool model. So we plan to switch the push model with all the actors running. So, and I got a feeling I don't have any ground truth to support it, which is microservices might be too expensive.
Okay.
That's my feeling.
That's very fair. I mean, that's fair. I'm not recommending microservices.
Yes.
I'm just asking you in this spectrum where you sit.
I guess the actor model should be more efficient because it is the same framework using the inter-thread communication. That one should be cheaper than sending a HTTP request there. That's my gut feeling. So very likely we go to an action model. In fact, the Twitter map demo you saw earlier is indeed using the actor model.
Okay.
It's already using the actor model, but they're using Scala. But this one we're using Java.
Cool.
Okay. All right. So I reached the end of my talk, but I want to say one more thing, which is in this text domain, machine learning models are used very, very common. And one common question people ask is, in the whole pipeline of data analysis, machine learning is a very important step. Where does machine learning fit into this whole architecture? So the way I see it is, we have this backend HTTP running at the database system to do ingestion, and we use the CloudBerry to do the visualization. And then we use the Texera, which is the old one we call it TextDB, that does the GUI-based formulation. And this whole suite of solutions can be used to help you do the data preparation for machine learning. You can use it to store data, visualize data, and then analyze the data. And then once you use this whole suite to prepare some data or label the data, then you can train a model here. So you get what I mean here. So you can use the whole thing to train a model. Model is more like maybe a matrix with all the parameters, right? Just a file. And then this model can be integrated back to either to Texera as one of the operators once we finish the kind of a UDF feature. Data is being ingested into the backend database, this model can be used as kind of UDF to do some offline processing, or even runtime when you do the visualization for those trees, you can even use UDF to do the online labeling. So the short message is the whole suite of solutions and machine learning are kind of complementary. We are focusing on the data preparation side. Okay. Conclusion here, and this is a acknowledgement. And thank you, especially Surajit, for all the support.
Questions, but you know, he's here hostage, so you can ask
it
if you want.
Excuse me. I have one question about the cloud barriers, lightning at that. So you mentioned that you don't have random access to the database, and that's the reason you don't get samples from the database to answer the queries. However, you have this database there that you have the data there. And you have access to the schema of that database to translate the query to the SQL query. Is that correct?
Correct. Well, the middleware has the access to data.
What I don't understand is, in realistic, either you're the tutor or a third party, right? When you're a third party, you get this data and store. Now you have access to this data. So where are you exactly? I'm confused with.
Our assumption is you have the backend database has a large amount of data. And the middleware knows the API, the schema. But the middleware is more like an accelerator. To some people, it's more like a data warehousing or accelerator that sits on top of your database, between the database and the application layer. So previously, the application layer talks to the database directly to ask queries, but those queries can be slow. By putting CloudBerry in between, which also knows the database schema, this layer can use all the techniques to meet those queries at the application layer much faster. This is the position.
Yes, also do the same, right?
Which one?
Tweetress, the analytics over Twitter. Mm. But they also do the crawling, they have the data, and also they do sampling and all those things to answer the questions.
Yes. CloudBerry is a general purpose software. It's not just for Twitter. The database can be anything. So it's not specific to Twitter.
OK. Thanks a lot for a very interesting talk.